Foster.
Thank you, Judge Brown. May it please the court. My name is David Foster, and I represent the appellant, Paul Cohane, in this important case at the intersection of Social Security benefits and IRS collection authority. When Congress passed Section 6331H, it balanced two competing priorities, the need to protect our nation's senior citizens and the need to protect the public fisc. So Congress granted the IRS authority to institute continuous levies on Social Security benefits, but only up to 15% of those levies. The IRS has concluded that that 15% limitation is effectively superfluous. The issue currently before this court is whether Mr. Cohane's challenge to that conclusion is timely, and it is under either of two different theories. First, under Treasury Regulation Section 301.7433-1G2, Mr. Cohane brought this suit within 2 years of his first reasonable opportunity to learn the elements of his cause of action.
Let's talk about his when that first occurred. Right now, what was there about the notice that he received when he first learned that he was being assessed with the levy? Why wasn't that the point at which he was put on notice? Your theory, as I understand it, is that it took multiple withdrawals from the Social Security benefits before he would have reason to know that maybe something was amiss.
Well, the IRS had authority, and no one disputes it here, to take a large percentage, north of 15% of Mr. Cohane's benefits, as much as it wanted to. So when he got that notice, which was from the Social Security Administration, not from the IRS, it stipulated he never received anything from the IRS.
And the key issue is whether it was more than 15% or less than 15%.
And it is. Well, the key issue, is whether
it was whether the single levy or...
Right. And so... Mr. Cohane saw that the notice...
So how does he know that any better later, after having several months of levies issued? Not issued, but money...
Well, he didn't.
Why does he know that any better then, than he knew it the first time?
Sometime after December 4th.
Well, but the issue isn't, what actually happened. It's what he was charged with knowing at the time. And in June 2005, didn't he have all the information that he would need to make this inquiry?
But the question in reasonable notice there's an element, as the Rosales case held, of whether the plaintiff can reasonably be expected to have made the inquiry in the first place. And when there's a right way that everybody agrees is legal for the IRS to do something, there's not enough when they do it to put him on notice that perhaps they've chosen
to... Why is there more in the second month or the third month or the fourth month or the fifth month? Why is there more through the accumulation of months in which the money is withheld?
I don't think our argument is that suddenly at month 8 or month 12 or month 14 the light was supposed to go on. Right. It's when did he, as a reasonable person, have enough information that he was supposed to ask more questions?
Do you agree that he's charged with knowledge of the law at all times?
That's what the case law holds.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Anybody who understood perfectly the tax code, which is a difficult thing to do in this area, would still know that the IRS had a perfectly legal way to do this. And given that it had a perfectly legal way to do this, there's no reason that he should have assumed they'd chosen to do it some other way. And there's a longstanding presumption that government officials are presumed, absent some evidence to the contrary, to have discharged their duties properly. In the Chemical Foundation case from the Supreme Court in 1926, in Alaska Airlines, and in those cases, the presumption was applied against the government in litigation, where the government showed up and said that someone was presumed not to have done their duties correctly. And here, Mr. Cohane ought to be entitled to the benefit of the same presumption, that the IRS was executing this levy by doing something.
Was there anything that would have prevented him in June 2005 from finding out that it was a single levy and not a monthly levy?
The being on notice that he should have asked is what would have prevented him. Now, as a abstract matter, that's the case in almost all of these cases that involve a cause of action accruing after the harm. In the medical malpractice cases, which is where this doctrine largely arose, there's nothing in theory that prevents the plaintiff from going to another doctor and saying, please do a full workup of me and see if I've been subject to medical malpractice. But that's not what the cases do. They say that until you're on notice that there's something that was done incorrectly, even if you're experiencing some pain, you have to be given some opportunity, some reason to ask more questions before the cause of action is held to accrue. And Rosales, I think, is an excellent case. It's the one that Congress cited in the legislative history to 7433. And the language in that case is whether someone could reasonably have been expected to inquire further. could reasonably have been expected to make the inquiry in the first place. And I think those two cases show something else. It's a statute of limitations, and everybody naturally thinks that there's a policy in favor of finality and enclosure, but both of those two cases, Rosales and Zeidler, are situations where the cause of action was held to have accrued long after, indeed in one of those cases decades after, the actual injury occurred. So when Congress set up the scheme in 7433, it fully intended that sometimes injury would happen and the cause of action wouldn't accrue until long later. So on June 6, 2005, the date that the district court concluded that Mr. Cohen known or should have known about the levy, he knew two things. He knew he owed the IRS money, and the IRS had a right to get it. And one way it could get it was by instituting a new levy under 6331A every month to take a large percentage of his Social Security check. And a reasonable person on June 6, 2005, and up until he found out the nature of the levy, would have assumed, and the notice would also lead one to assume he received from the Social Security Administration, that the IRS was doing that pursuant to lawful authority. So given that, the first time that he had a reasonable opportunity and was put on notice he should ask more questions was when he found out sometime after December 4th, 2006, that the IRS was relying on the continuing effect of a single paper levy to take his Social Security benefits. And at that point, he was supposed to ask more questions, and he did, and he had 2 years from that date to file suit, which he did. And for that reason, under the Treasury regulation, which is probably the simplest and most direct way to resolve this case, his suit is timely.
What do you do with the other circuits that have rejected application of this doctrine in this statute? How do you distinguish those cases?
The other circuits that have rejected the doctrine are our second argument, the continuing violations doctrine. And I realize their arguments in support of both of them are somewhat similar. But the other circuits that have rejected this doctrine have done so on different facts. The question here is reasonableness in both situations, which is an inherently fact-intensive inquiry. And the two cases that the district court relied on in other circuits, Kovacs and DeZura from the Seventh and First Circuits, if you look at the facts, it makes sense why they rejected those. In Kovacs, the claim was that there had been a bankruptcy discharge order. And in that bankruptcy discharge order, the IRS followed up with collection action. And any reasonable person who was sitting in a situation where there was follow-up IRS collection action would know immediately that there was some problem, that we thought this debt was discharged and the IRS is trying to collect on it. So, of course, there's no continuing violation, and that's Kovacs. And in DeZura, in the First Circuit, you have a similar situation. There was an Andrew Wyeth painting that the IRS had taken, and if it didn't sell it at the first auction, it was supposed to give it back. And when the moment that the taxpayer got notice that the IRS had scheduled a second auction, any reasonable person knowing there was a section auction and charged with knowledge of the law would have said, huh, it must not have sold at the first auction. So for that reason, the court said there's no continuing violation because you knew right at that point everything you needed to know. And that's just not the case on the facts here, because Mr. Cohen had the problem that there was an entirely legal way for the IRS to do what it was supposed to do. And I think that goes to the fundamental nature of his claim here. Congress passed this requirement in 6331H, the 15% limitation, to keep the IRS from taking senior citizens too far below the amount that Congress had granted to them without some kind of reasoned decision-making from the administrative agency, the IRS here. And, you know, you can take them down to 85% of those Social Security benefits, and if you make a monthly determination that you think that's really important to collect more, that's okay. But we can't put it on autopilot for anything more than 15%. And that's what happened here. The decision was put on autopilot, and every month they took the money. And in fact, not only was so much on autopilot, I think one of the interesting facts in this case, is that even after the IRS agreed to take the levy off, they took it out the next month. I mean, it was really difficult to turn this off once they got it turned on.
Doesn't this idea of it being on autopilot, though, work against your continuing violation theory? I mean, even you describe this as, you know, a single act that had continuing effect. But the continuing violation doctrine requires continuing violations.
Well, then there are two different kinds of continuing violations. There's a single act of placement of the levy. But I can promise you that every time Mr. Cohen came up $451.90 short every month, there was new and fresh harm. And it was illegal.
It was a continuing injury, but my understanding is that if they had done this every month, it would have been perfectly legal.
That's right, but they didn't do it every month. It would have been perfectly legal if they had followed the requirements, but they didn't follow the requirements of not instituting on a continuous basis. And each time they took $451.90, it was a new illegal act. It all stemmed from an act that took place when they put this levy into place. But certainly on the last time on July 26, 2007, when they took the $451.90, that was a new act. It was illegal when they did it then, as it was the first time.
Well, then how is it ever possible to distinguish between one act with continuing effect and continuing illegal acts?
I think new and fresh harm is one way to look at it. For example, if you're a patient and the doctor does something wrong to you, and you leave the hospital and nothing happens for a while, and it's the same injury, and 3 or 4 years later, the fact that they left a sponge in you causes some new injury. All that injury is attributable, with nothing new happening in the intervening, from the doctor who did the medical malpractice. All of that injury is attributable to leaving the sponge in.
But your theory is as if, and the sponge is going to hurt once it reveals itself, or there's some pain that you're feeling, but that you're going to feel the pain each day. And each day is a new harm. That's your theory. Your theory is not the sponge theory. Your theory is each day that you're in pain is a new injury. That doesn't seem where the doctrine is.
I think the question goes back to, can you attribute the harm to some initial act, and does harm continue out through there? And I agree that it's not exactly identical to the sponge theory, but I think doctrine...
Just on the malpractice theory, generally, the first day that you feel the injury, okay, and so that's the day that we'd agree starts, you would say, well, the next day you feel the injury too, so there's a new harm, and the next day, and so it would just keep going on forever. There would really be no...
There's two types of malpractice cases, and I think if you look at this court's decision in Page, it's a little bit different than the hypothetical we've been talking about. It's not a situation where there's one sponge. It's a situation where over 20 years there was an inappropriate prescription of medications, and in that situation, it was similar down the line. And I see if you have any further questions, I'd like to reserve what's left for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Janet Bradley. I'm with the U.S. Department of Justice Tax Division, and I represent the United States in this appeal. This morning, it appears that the court understands the position that the government has taken in this appeal, that again, in June 2005, when the government issued one single paper manual levy to the Social Security Administration and started then to collect on an ongoing basis, that actually was the discrete act that was discoverable here by the taxpayer. And indeed, as taxpayer has admitted in their brief and here again this morning, they were aware of the levy when it first occurred in June 2005. And a month before that, they had in fact received a letter from the Social Security Administration.
The question is whether they were aware of the levy. It's whether they were aware that a single levy that would be supported by multiple withdrawals over months was illegal. What knowledge, why would they have reason to know that from receiving a notice that $450 plus some change is going to be withdrawn every month?
Well, again, for purposes of Section 7433, the key inquiry for purposes of when an action accrues is when the taxpayer had a reasonable opportunity to discover the elements of a potential possible cause of action. And again, back in June, at that time, taxpayer was well aware he had not filed his long overdue 1994 tax return.
Yeah, there's no question that he knew that he had to owe money, but that's not the issue here, right? The issue is whether it was supported by a single levy or multiple levies each month. Why would he have any reason to know, to be on notice about that seeming rather technical detail from receiving the notice that money is going to be taken from his Social Security benefit?
Well, again, at that time, as the government has cited at page 36 of our brief, most of the appellant's argument goes to the IRS's authority to levy and how we can go about doing that on Social Security benefits, and certain other specified payments. We maintain, and we cite the cases on page 36 of our brief, that the IRS has two options to effectuate a levy on Social Security benefits. And we maintain it's lawful either under subpart A, where the IRS issues one standard old-fashioned hard copy of a levy, or alternatively, we have the means to do it under subpart H. Again,
but when he gets this in the mail and he opens the mail and sees that there's going to be a levy exacted on his Social Security benefits, why would he have reason to know that there would be a difference between whether there's a legal difference between whether this levy is executed, whether this money is taken under a single levy or multiple levies? Why would he have any reason to know that when he opens the mail?
As Judge Kavanaugh referred to, there are a number of circuits that have held that a taxpayer is charged with knowledge of the legal consequences of the facts they discover. So at the time in June...
So the practical rule, the effect of your argument will be that whenever you get anything from the government, you better call a lawyer, check it out, because it might be...
Well, you know, again, in most circumstances, it would probably be a prudent course of action if something like this does occur, to at that time actually, you know, inquire into whether there is something either right or wrong. And again,
so the government gives me a notice that I ought to approach it with a healthy skepticism that maybe this is illegal, right? So I better get hold of a lawyer.
I don't think you need to assume that it's illegal, but again, at that time...
That would be the prudent thing to do.
It would be the prudent thing to do.
Well, that's quite a statement to make, isn't it? That when the government acts, that you ought to be careful about it. They may be doing something unlawful here.
No, and again, the government just didn't act in a vacuum here. Again, the fact of the matter is, taxpayer didn't file his return, and the government did everything it was required by law to do in this case, insofar as after we assessed the taxes and before the levy even issued, we had sent the taxpayer four notices of intent to levy, two in 2002.
And I don't dispute that. Now, he knew it was coming. He knew that money was going to be taken from his Social Security benefit. Now, I don't think that's the issue. The issue is he supposed to be on notice that the way the government is doing this may be unlawful? Not the fact that they're withholding money from his Social Security benefit, but that the way they're doing it is unlawful. There's nothing about the letter that would suggest that, right? It's the only way you get there is that he's charged with knowledge of this rather technical distinction in the statute between
Again,
A and
the
H.
Courts who have addressed it, for example, the Tenth Circuit in the Wallace case, was essentially the same case the court has before it this morning. It was not a case where the taxpayer wasn't aware of the levy, knew of the levy, and they argued that it wasn't until the levy ceased that the statute of limitations should run. The Tenth Circuit rejected that argument. Again, in the Wallace case, as in several other cases, the taxpayers have presented the argument, as taxpayer is here, that there was some sort of a continuing
violation. This is great news for tax lawyers, maybe not such great news for taxpayers.
Again, in this case, the IRS, their argument hinges on the fact that they believe that the IRS can only levy under subpart H. And the government maintains, and all of the district courts who have considered that today.
And all taxpayers are presumed to know that distinction.
No, but again, it would be prudent to use that word again, that a taxpayer has some duty when they have certain facts before them to go ahead and to look to see if anything is amiss. You know, here again, the minute the taxpayer found something might have been amiss, filed his overdue return, you know, 12 years late, the IRS, in very prompt fashion, accepted the return as filed, withdrew the levy, and refunded.
That he filed late is completely irrelevant to this case, right? That has nothing to do with the issue before us, right? The only issue before us is whether there's some significance to the fact that when he got the notice, when the money's finally being taken out, or he knows it's going to be taken out, whether it was done under a single levy or multiple levies. That's the only issue, right?
I would agree that it is crucial to know when the taxpayer's cause of action accrued.
Right.
That is the key determination here, and the district court found in this case that the taxpayer had information before him regarding the levy, regarding the amount of the levy. He was aware at that time that the amount taken out was in excess of 15%, and the district court here relying, I believe, was on the...
But he had no reason to know that 15% was a significant threshold, right, unless we charge him with that knowledge.
Well, he wouldn't have had any reason to know with the 15%, but again, the taxpayers are charged with knowledge that the IRS can levy to collect overdue taxes, and the service did everything it was required. Again, had he been at his last known address, he would have received one of the four notices of intent to levy, and at that time, Congress provided taxpayers with all the procedural protections needed. So before that levy even occurred, we tried on four occasions. The liability was in 94. I believe the tax was assessed in 1998. We issued two notices of intent to levy in 2000 and two more in 2002. So he had the opportunity at that time. If he thought that something was amiss, he didn't need to go to a lawyer. He could have at that time had review in an administrative determination by an appeals officer whether there was anything amiss. And at that time, he could have, you know, fully fleshed
your
out.
The central point is that he received the letter. The letter was received in June 05.
One of the central points is that the month before the levy, the Social Security Administration did inform him before the levy was to occur in June, and he admitted receiving that letter.
Right.
That he had all the details to have a reasonable opportunity.
Right.
And again, he doesn't need to know with an absolute certainty that he has a cause of action.
That letter informed him of the levy and the amount.
Correct.
So all this, these notices beforehand are
no, at that point,
but that's...
No, I just, in this case, I just would like to assure the court that there was nothing that the IRS didn't properly do that resulted in the levy here. So just as background, that's what occurred. And again, as the court has referred to cases this morning, the courts that have addressed in Wallace, the Tenth Circuit, virtually the identical scenario is here. Other courts who have looked to a similar, you know, scenario as best as it can be analogous to this case, but albeit these are the cases that we think are controlling here, the courts have looked to when that first injury occurred. So it's not analogous to the sponge situation. Again, when that first injury occurred was back in June 2005, and then there was just an ongoing effect. Unfortunately, for purposes of the continuous levy, that's just a term of art. And just in normal speak, one would think of anything that goes on as continuous, but there is a distinction. It's ongoing. And again, any of the cases that appellant's been citing here, be it the sponge situation or the Rosales case or this court's decision in Page, that's really a tort doctrine when, again, from the initial harm, you couldn't quite know that you were going to be injured. So we submit those cases aren't applicable.
I just want to make sure that I understand something that you said earlier. I thought that you said that the IRS is not limited to a continuous levy only under subsection H. Is that correct?
All right. Let me sub. I know this gets confusing because, again, it's just a term of art.
It's confusing, but all the taxpayers are presumed to know it. Go ahead.
What happens is, and you know, Congress chose that term, unfortunately, but a continuous levy, as that term is technically used, is authorized in subpart H of 6331.
Right, and that continuous levy is limited to 15%.
That continuous levy, not only on Social Security, but there are certain specified payments. And the reason that all came about is, I think, is in the legislative history. Congress realized that there are a lot of federal employees that are getting, you know, their paychecks, who nonetheless owe the Treasury money. And this was a streamlined way to go ahead and just automatically take 15%.
It's not your position that under subsection A, you could have this continuous levy. You can do that only under H, correct?
A continuous levy as that word is technically used in subpart 8. The government maintains, and it's been the law, that the government has broad authority under subpart A to issue the good old-fashioned hard paper levies. And those levies, when they're issued, if the levy in this case, I believe, was for roughly $18,000, $19,000, of course there was no way out of his first monthly check to get that. So there is a formula in Section 6334 under which there are certain exclusions and exemptions that have to be calculated so that we may not we can't get 100% typically. There is some reduction, but that levy will have an ongoing effect. So that's the way I would do my best to distinguish that. Unfortunately, when you hear the term continuous, it's really a term of art here for purposes of
statute. So what you're saying is the paper levy doesn't have to be done every month.
Absolutely.
Or if it would exceed the amount that you could take in that month.
Correct. A good old-fashioned hard paper manual levy that from the first month would have an ongoing effect to collect that tax liability, which is what occurred here.
But if that's true, then there wouldn't have been any violation here.
Well, exactly. Exactly. Again, the appellant's position, again, seems to be of the view, and they don't cite any cases to support that H is the only way to go. Here again, be it in June or December or July of any of the 3 years, the levy was lawful. So we really think that the district court correctly examined the existing case law, the facts before, in concluding that taxpayers sued here brought more than 2 years from the date of which the action accrued in June 2005 was untimely. So we ask this court to affirm the district court's decision of Judge Kennedy, please.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Foster had some time left, right? All right.
Thank you, Judge Brown. I'd like to just make two quick points. The IRS's position on the merits, which have come up, is that something called a continuous levy, they're limited to 15%. But if they do the same thing and call it the continuing effect of a single levy, that's not subject to the limit. Now, that's merits that we vigorously disagree with them on the merits. But for purposes of the timelessness issue, let's assume they're correct for a minute. If the government is correct that they had authority to do this all along, that only supports our point on the timeliness issue. If it was absolutely the case, as they contend, under either our theory, which is that there were two ways to do it, one of which required a little bit more work, or theirs, which is they could do exactly the same thing, either way, there was no reasonable way that Mr. Cohen should know, even if he knew everything about the law. It's not that there was something about the law that he was unclear about. It's that if he had known they had two ways, the government's position on timeliness is that he was supposed to suspect that they were doing it the way that was either definitely illegal or arguably illegal.
If he knew this distinction between A and H, and he gets notice that they're going to be taking 40% out, that doesn't put him on notice?
Absolutely not. And see, that's I think kind of the critical fact here is that they could have taken.
Why not? I'm not following.
They could have taken 40%. If they had gone through the trouble of making the administrative determination every month that they wanted to do that. Mm-hmm. And so when he saw that, that's what a reasonable person would have thought. That's what they're going to do. They're going to make a determination every month instead of putting it on autopilot. And so the key point here is even if he had known the law, if he knew everything about it and had written the law, it wouldn't matter because there was an indisputably right way to do this. And the government chose not to do it that way, and he shouldn't be charged with suspecting or with assuming that the government was acting illegally when it had an indisputable way to do it. And we ask that the case be reversed and remanded for a determination on the merits of the IRS's interpretation of what the word continuous means. Thank you very much.
How much is at stake here?
At this point, probably about $400. And the IRS, the statute in 7433 explicitly disclaims any amount in controversy requirement. Thank you.
Thank you. The case will be submitted.